Yo, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Baywatch Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Mr. Span, and I am here tonight with my lovely wife, Mrs. Span. Say what's up to the people, baby.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm okay.
All right.
You
look nervous, like, oh my God,
I'm doing this again. I don't know why I look like that.
I don't know, like, you kind of like a podcast vet now, babe. You do more podcasts than a lot of people.
Not at all.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure of it. we are back for episode 11 of the Baywatch Podcast, and we've been getting some numbers, babe. Like, people have been really, like, enjoying the Baywatch Podcast, especially after doing the Surviving R. Kelly joints.
That was a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot.
And you know what? When I, like, came up with the idea, I was like, we should do it and do a show every night right after. Like, immediately after I said it, I was like, why did you say that? Because you was like, all right, we could do that.
And it worked out. I mean, we were up pretty late at night and stuff or whatever, but, yo, like, we...
Oh, you were still on vacation.
I was still on vacation. You know, those two magical weeks of... Not having to worry about a damn thing relating to gas or regulators, pipe fittings or nipple trays or wet holes or anything.
Hey, pipe down.
I'm just saying, a lot of my job has something to do with, like, if you didn't know what I was talking about, you'd think I was talking about something sexual.
But why would there ever be a tray full of nipples?
I mean, I don't know why they call those pipes nipples, but, you know.
All right, okay.
But other than that, baby, what have you been up to? What are people? What should the people know that Mrs. Span has been up to for the past week?
Nothing. Minding my black ass business.
God damn. Baby, you get nothing here.
Nah.
None of your fucking business. No, but yeah, man, we went to go to the movie. We went to the movies last night. And we saw something new. We went to go see If Beale Street Could Talk last night. And we're going to talk about that movie with you guys tonight. But before we do that, of course, we got to remind you guys how to get in touch with us over here at the Baywatch Podcast and let your voices be heard. Go ahead and hit up that hotline at area code 313-288-0485. That's area code 313-288-0485. Leave those voicemail messages. Of course, we'll play them on the show and respond right here. You can also email us here at feedback@thebaywatchpodcast.com. That's feedback@thebaywatchpodcast.com. Leave us those emails and we will read those emails here live on the show. You can not watch the show live, but you can go to www.thebaywatchpodcast.com and you can listen to the show there. And we actually did have a poll on the last time that we did the show, and that was relating to our coverage of the Surviving R. Kelly docuseries. So we're going to give you guys those poll results a little bit later, but you can go to the website, you can vote in the poll, you can leave comments there, you can donate to the show as often as you like, as much as you like, and of course we appreciate every dime over here at the Span Report Podcast Network. And you can go there, you can go to the store, you can go to our Span Report Podcast Network store, get yourself some Baywatch Podcast merchandise, get you a t-shirt or a hoodie or a, you know, laptop cover or mouse pad, whatever it is that you feel like you want to get. You can pretty much get that over there at our store over on TeePublic. So those links will be in the show notes as well. But before we get into our coverage of If Beale Street Could Talk, we're going to go into some of our poll results for the Surviving R. Kelly series. And the questions that we asked on the website was whether or not after watching that 6-part series, was your mind changed at all? By what you saw concerning R. Kelly. And, babe, do you think anybody's minds were changed after watching that?
Sure. Yeah. I'll give people the benefit of the doubt.
The benefit of the doubt. Okay. So here's the interesting thing about that, right? Because, there are people who may not have had their minds changed and it was a good thing. And then there are those people who didn't have their mind changed and it was a bad thing, right? And I thought it was quite interesting. So some of the answers to this poll were as follows. I don't care. I separate him from his music, which was a no answer that they mind was not changed. I can't believe I supported him this long, which was a yes answer. I always thought he was a creep needing to be locked up. That was a no answer. Their mind wasn't changed. And then there was, I was not aware of all of the accusations, which was a yes answer. If you had to guess, baby, which one do you think was the...
Which one do I think is the most?
Yeah.
I don't care.
Surprisingly, that got no votes.
Oh.
Well. Actually, I want to big up the audience here. Like, I'm glad nobody who listens to us, like, also listens to R. Kelly. Like, man, fuck what y'all talk about. I don't care about none of that shit. I'm glad that y'all who were listening to us and listening to that show or watched that show didn't feel that way. So that actually got zero votes. Nobody voted on that shit. The other one was, I separate him from his music. That also did not get any votes in this poll. So 0% for the both of them. Now, with 12% of the vote, though, I can't believe I supported him this long. They voted yes. Their mind was changed by what they heard and what they saw on that particular series. So 12% of people said yes on that one. On the I always thought he was a creep needing to be locked up. Their mind wasn't changed. That one got 31% of the vote. That was number two. 31% of the people who listened to the Baywatch podcast thought that he should have, they always thought he should have been locked up. And 56.2% of people who listened to the show and who watched that show said that I was not aware of all of the accusations and their mind was changed by what they saw. Which I'm kind of, you know, I'm kind of surprised that like that many people were not aware of all of the things that were surrounding that dude. And it took them watching that series or maybe listening to the show or whatever before their minds were changed about that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I can see how someone didn't know all of the accusations. Like, I didn't know all of the accusations.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, like, people who kind of canceled him out in their mind, you know, when the first accusations came out, or even like when the tape came out,
yeah.
Then they kind of just now, since they don't support him, they don't fuck with him, they may not even pay attention to new accusations or new news. And there's been plenty, you know, since the tape. So yeah. I could see how people might not, because I definitely didn't know all the accusations. So,
yeah, I mean, there were some things that I wasn't privy to, like the whole pregnancy thing with Aaliyah was something that I wasn't aware of. I had heard the story of Geronda Pace through, like, you know, news clippings and stuff when she first kind of came out. She had broke her NDA to kind of come out and tell her story. And then there was the, you know, the revelations of him having a sex cult, so to speak, and the women that were, like, being brainwashed to be with him and whatnot. But I think the more surprising thing, and I probably shouldn't have even been surprised at that, was the fact that Aaliyah was pregnant. Or had been pregnant while dealing with that dude. But other than that, I mean, you know, I'm just happy that, like, there are more people just kind of taking a serious look at, like, man, what were we doing and why are we still dealing with this guy? So, yeah, man, that was the poll results for episode 10. And we thank everybody who voted in that poll. And we appreciate that, man. We're looking forward to some more listener feedback here at the Baywatch Podcast. But we are about to get into our review of If Beale Street Could Talk, directed by Barry Jenkins, who was actually the director of Moonlight, which won Best Director. I mean, I'm sorry, Best Film last year, I believe it was. And we saw that movie last night. And first things first, baby, overall, what were your thoughts on the film?
I mean, I loved it. I really loved it. I think it's it's super emotional, super touching. Just, I mean, it was just beautiful just to look at. Like, yeah. I could have probably looked at it on mute and still cried. Like, just the everything from, like, the lighting to the scenery, the cinematography. I just thought it was really beautiful. And I loved the story, which is hard to say about a story that doesn't necessarily have, like, a happy ending, or, like, it's not, like, a everything's not kind of, like, neat and tidy at the end.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I still love the story.
And you had read the book before.
I read the book, but, like, you know, in, like, long ago.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't remember I didn't remember most of it. I remember like the general idea of it, but I didn't really remember most of like details or what happened or whatever.
Yeah. I had never read the book. And I didn't really know what to expect going into it. I think one of the things I was a little bit annoyed with the fact that the release of the film was so limited.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because for like, I had been trying to see this for like a couple weeks. Yeah. I've been trying to see this movie for a couple weeks, and like there was one theater in like the Detroit area that was showing it at first. And it was like one theater, one screen, a couple show times, and that was it. And we finally found another theater other than that one that was going to be playing the film. And even when we got there last night, they switched the theater and the showtime and the whole shit. And it was kind of crazy with that. And I think this movie would have probably did a lot better at the box office had there been a more widespread distribution of this film where people had more of an opportunity to go see it. But as far as the film itself, man, I thought that film was amazingly beautiful. And like kind of echoing some of the sentiments that you had, baby, like I was sitting there watching that film and I'm like, man, Barry Jenkins, it's something about the cinematography of that film where like they really get black people looking amazing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like it's a way to like make like black people, they almost glowed on the screen.
Yeah.
The lighting, the angles, the like some of the close-ups, like you felt the emotion in the scene a lot of times. You know, your boy Span almost teared up a couple times. I ain't gonna lie. I played it off, you know, like
there are many moments in this film where you could tear up, and they're not even, and it's not even like moments where like something super emotional is going on, or like it's like things that would make you cry in a different movie.
Yeah.
A lot of it is just like I could have probably cried in like the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Just like their facial expressions and like the way when they were, you know, it was just what was really getting to me though was like the way that their love was kind of portrayed like with just like their facial, like the way they would kind of smile at each other.
Yeah.
Like their the way that their faces were, and just like the, it just could just, you could just swell up and just really sit there and cry. If you really let yourself think more deeply into their love and that, just the love story part of it, you could just cry your face off.
Yeah. And so for those of you who aren't privy and hadn't read the book before, If Beale Street Could Talk follows a story of Tish Rivers and Alonzo Fonny Hunt. These two had practically grown up together, grown up to love one another, and they expressed their love through some tremendously difficult circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
We come in on the story where they're looking for a place to live.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they're just kind of asking, are they really ready for that? And sometimes like the story was kind of told through flashbacks. You know, they were giving us some flashbacks as to, you know, what brought us to this point, and certain aspects of, you know, where this story was. But as the story, as I want to say, like the most of this story is told to us through a flashback, so to speak. Only because, like, we know that he's dealing with this legal issue where he was accused of rape, but he could not have, you know, circumstances determined that he probably wasn't the one who raped this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going back and we're trying, they're telling us the story of how he ended up where he is,
mm-hmm.
but also kind of like how their love kind of like kept them both together and kept them both almost sane throughout all of it.
Okay, well, here's a different way to look at it.
Okay.
Okay, so imagine you have three pieces of cloth that you want to sew together.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to layer them on top of each other, and you're going to put going to thread your needle and put it through each of the three pieces of cloth each time, come up, and loop it around again.
Right.
So, I don't know, some people would kind of say that there are three kind of defined storylines that are all sewn together to make one cohesive story.
Right.
So when you're saying flashbacks, it's really like the story is being sewn together. So each time the needle goes through, it goes through one story to the next to the other, and then it goes back and goes back through one story to the next to the other, which kind of gives you this perspective of, you know what happened,
right?
But the characters in the story don't know what happened. So that's why you feel like you're going back and forth. You know, you feel like it's a flashback, but it wasn't like someone is remembering something. It's just the way that the story is being told. So it's each of these three kind of defined stories, like their love story, then the story of the alleged like rape and that, and then kind of like a story about what it was like for Black people at that time, the struggles for Black men. So it's all kind of being like looped together through different situations and different circumstances that they kind of encounter. So it's not like Tish is sitting there and then she has a flashback or she just remembers something and then it comes back to her. It's like, this happened, but it happened because of this, and then this happened and it happened because of this, and like it's kind of all being like woven together. So that's kind of how I looked at it.
This is why you're brilliant, babe.
I'm not brilliant.
You are brilliant. This is why you're brilliant, because you articulated that a hell of a lot better than I could have.
Well, thank you.
But another aspect of this that story though that I thought was striking was the family dynamic with both Tish and Fonny. As the story is being told, Fonny definitely does have you would get the impression that Fonny definitely has more of a connection to Tish's family than he does his own. I got that impression that he was around them a hell of a lot more, that they maybe showed him a little bit more love than his own family.
Yeah.
Because his own family just seems to like...
Well, his mom and his sisters.
His mom and his sisters. Not his dad. His dad loved him a lot. His dad said, he's the most important person in my life. But his mom and his sisters kind of snooty, holy rollers.
Yeah.
And one of the more pivotal parts of this movie, one of the things that I thought was a really good scene was the scene where they actually called, like, once they found out that Tish was pregnant, they decided that they were going to, like, just tell Fonny's side of the family what was going on. And they invited them over to the house so that they can kind of, you know, break the news to them that, like, you know, we're going to have a baby and our families are pretty much going to be joined. Let me see if I got this clip here.
A child is coming. It's your grandchild. I don't understand you. It's your grandchild. What difference does it make how he gets here? The child ain't got nothing to do with that. Ain't none of us got nothing to do with that. That child. Take your shit with you.
All right. That scene there was after Fonny's family found out that Tish and Fonny were expecting, and
Fonny's in jail.
Fonny's in jail
at this time. At this point, that adds to why.
Yeah, Fonny's in jail at this point, and Tish is young. Like Tish is like 19.
She is 19.
Fonny's 22. I believe they explained that. And Fonny doesn't have necessarily the history of having like gainful employment And, you know, they're worried about who's going to take care of the baby. At least that was the concern of his mom and his sisters. But not only that, his mom and his sisters already had a negative attitude about it because of their religion. You know, his mother, Fani's mom, talked about the baby being born into, you know, born of sin.
And it was going to wither away in her womb.
It was going to wither away in her womb. Like, that was some, it was some really hateful shit to say to a young woman who was expecting her first child. Who's scared? Yeah. Because you can tell, like, there was a scene where she's sitting in the kitchen and her mom comes home and her mom doesn't really press her about it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
She knows.
She comes home and she's like, you know, she's asking, well, did you see the lawyer? You know, just kind of, you know, being real conversational, but she knows something is wrong with her. Mm-hmm. But she's not going to press her on it. And then she just, you know, kind of opens up to a mother to tell her.
Yeah.
And, that was something that I thought was, like, you know, kind of interesting in the sense of, like, with it, we're dealing in the sense of, like, the 60s, like, late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. She's 19, but, like, teenage pregnancy is still something that's, you know, highly...
Not necessarily teenage pregnancy, because people were, you know, women, a lot of women got married out of wedlock. A lot of people got married at 18 and 19 in that time, especially, like, if you didn't go to college and like, you know, you're the man, you know, had a job right out of high school or like owned a company or a farm or whatever it may be, you know, their family business.
Yeah,
a lot of women did not go to college. They, you know, 18, got married, start having kids. So not necessarily teen pregnancy, but like having a baby without being married.
And juxtapose, like, Fani's mom's reaction to the, you know, the news that she's about to be a grandparent, and Tisha's family when they find out that, you know, there's a new life coming into the family. And I got that clip also. I just kind of wanted to play this here also.
They're not too much for Tish.
They pulled out the Hennessy for this one.
All right. What's going on?
This is a sacrament, and no, I ain't lost my mind. We are drinking to new life. Tish gonna have Fani's baby.
All right. Now, at that moment, like, I could, you, like, again, we talked about that girl being really, really, really scared. Mm-hmm. And then here's, like, you know, what one would, like, deem, like, her father's reaction. Like, how would my daddy react to me being pregnant? And we're talking about the shame that comes with being, you know, pregnant, out of wedlock. It's late 60s, early 70s. And the way that her family just kind of made her feel in that moment, like, she wasn't by herself. Kind of made sure that, like, her self-esteem was intact. Like, her sister at one point, and that they didn't show it in this clip, but her sister was like, yo, unbow your head, sister. Because she was sitting on the couch, you know, almost ashamed at, you know, having to tell them what had happened between her and Fani. And this was before the whole scene where they had to, you know, where they had the other family over to tell them, you know, what was going on. But, like, what did you get from that? That scene, babe. Like, how did you feel about it?
From when she told, like, her dad and sister? Because the mom already knew.
Yeah, the mom already knew. I'm just saying, like, the
Sharon already knew.
With the rest of the family, like, how they reacted to it. Like, what did you get from that particular scene?
I mean, it was endearing. I thought it was, like, it's refreshing to see a black family on TV, especially that's supposed to be, like, in the 60s and 70s, to be so, like, warm and supportive. And it just kind of reminded me of, like, the way, kind of, like, I guess, like, the way that my mom and dad are. Mm-hmm. Like, they're very, like, I could have come to them and probably told them any number of things, And they would have been the same way. Like, at first, like, my dad's going to be like, I need a drink. Mm-hmm. But then they'll just be like, all right, we're going to make it do what it do. Like, mm-hmm. And it made me sad also that I didn't have a big sister to be like, you know, like, her sister was very much, like, in support of her, like, had her back.
And very protective.
Very protective of her. It made me kind of wish, like, oh, I wish I had a big sister. But, like I said, it was super refreshing to see, like, especially just, like, a black family that wasn't, like, super holier than thou. Like, you could tell, like, they were making ends meet. Like, they weren't wealthy or rich, but, like, right. they had an apartment, you know, small. But, like, you know, they got out the special Hennessy.
You know, at first I didn't know that was Hennessy. I had like, when, yeah. I was looking at it because he's like, man, what's the special occasion? You know what I'm saying? Because usually when, you know, I don't associate Hennessy with special occasions. So then I had to like, I was like, okay. And I'm looking at the bottle and it looked like a champagne bottle almost, or a wine bottle. And I just wasn't That's used how to the seeing
old bottles were.
Yeah, I wasn't used to seeing Henny in bottles like that. And they had like, that was another one of those little bitty tidbits of like the Steiny bottles for like when they were drinking beer when his partner came home from prison and everything. Like just little things like that that I was catching on. But yeah, I looked at that scene and I was just like, man, like there's a whole lot of people who wish their family was as supportive, even in a time where like, yo, we really don't know what we gonna do.
Yeah.
Who wish that their family was as supportive as Tisha's family was to her in that moment. Like they just kind of wrapped their arms around her and made her feel like, you got support. You're not by yourself in this.
Yeah.
While this is going on, like we said, Fonny, you know, he's locked up. He's pretty much locked up on charges where, you know, he's locked up on rape charges. And they're trying to, like, get a lawyer for him.
Well, they have a lawyer. But they're trying to pay him.
They're trying to pay him. When it comes to Fonny's story, we know that there's a deep and passionate love for Tish. But with him being locked away, you kind of get the feeling of that love for Tish is the only thing that's really keeping that dude going.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't really have a whole hell of a lot of hope where he is. Like, you know, she goes to visit him at one point and he's like, do you realize what's happening to me in here?
Mm-hmm.
And I know this was supposed, like, it's like a commentary on, like, because it's a book by James Baldwin. so this is commentary about, you know, how many men of color who are in the criminal justice system are, you know, almost victimized to the point where, like, just on the strength of them being black and on the strength of them being poor, many of them are being held up on charges that they shouldn't be in prison for.
Mm-hmm.
They can't afford, you know, they can't afford competent representation, and you know the system being stacked against them to keep them in, you know, keep them pretty much locked up. When it came to like they're like, I don't know, let's kind of switch gears a little bit. Fonny went out of his way to like kind of show her how can I put this? I'm trying to articulate this right.
Just say it.
Yeah, I want to just say it, but I don't want to. Like, there was this, like, yo, you knew that Fonny had been in love with this girl all his life. Like, that was the impression that I got. Like from, like, even, like, there's scenes where, like, they're taking baths as kids and stuff like that, but from, like, you get the sense of, with the way that they were looking at each other, with the way that he protected her, you know, when they were out in public, with the way he would get upset with her when she would, you know, try to protect him, because he's like, no, don't try to do that for me, because of how he understands how different it is for him to do that and for her to do that for him. Like, I got that feeling like this dude has been in love with her since they were very little kids.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. I don't know. I'm just like, I'm just, I don't don't know. I don't know how to articulate what I'm...
I don't even know what you want to talk about. I don't... I can't help you.
I don't either. Like, I'm drawing a blank. Like, because I want to talk more about Fonny's story without so much focusing on the fact that this dude is locked up.
Okay, well, there is... He's an artist, and that was kind of one of the things that probably his family was looking down on him for, because it seemed like he went to, like, trade school. He decided, this is not for me. But, like...
He picked up, like, 1,000 trades.
Stole all the tools and stuff. Like, he was having a hard time finding work. He was an artist. He was kind of like a cool cat, you know, like,
yeah,
really into jazz music and things like that. And at that time, those were like our version now of like a thug or like a hood nigga. Like,
I don't know.
Those were our kind of versions of that. He was kind of running with the crowd, like his friend, you know, had got out of jail. He was kind of, you know, running with a certain crowd of people, and it kind of was implied that he was a certain type of dude. Not to say he was a bad dude, but it's like, you poor, you doing what you can. You probably gonna steal, you gonna do whatever.
Okay, so I got a question for you, because you read the book. Was there the impression in the book, or did they write about this in the book, that he was involved with like a bad crowd or anything like that in the book?
They made it seem as though, okay, it was clear that his family had a problem with him because he didn't have any education and didn't have a good job. And mm-hmm. he didn't go to the military. Mm-hmm. And those were kind of like the three options for a black man. Mm-hmm. Like, at that time, mm-hmm. You know, you either get an education, so go to school, go to college, you know, finish high school and that kind of thing, go to college, mm-hmm. or out of high school, get a good job, yeah. or even don't finish high school and still get a really good job, or go to the military. So that was kind of, to me, like, that was kind of implied. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't necessarily that he ran with a bad crowd of people, but it was, like, his choice and, like, what he was doing with his life. He was living, like, in the village, kind of in, like, an artsy scene. He was just working on his wood crafting, mm-hmm. you know, like,
sculptures and
he
stuff.
Had a friend that had the restaurant that would sometimes feed him. He was, you know, it was where he lived.
Yeah.
You know, his little kind of garden level apartment situation. It was, like, all of that. So not necessarily to say, like, oh, he was a bad dude. He was stealing. He was lying. He was doing this, that, and the other. But, like, it was kind of implied, like, he was scraping by. Like,
yeah,
he might have, like, took an apple from the store. But not, like, he was out here robbing people. Nothing like that. But it was just, like, it was very clear that, you know, he was the kind of person that a lot of people, especially, like, the way his mom was, that they would kind of look down on.
Yeah. Like, and like we said, like, his mom, Mrs. Hunt, and his sisters and stuff, like, they were very judgmental. They were very churchy. Almost, like, you know, you would get the impression, if you see this film, you would get the impression that they may have been a little bit hypocritical in a lot of the shit that they had going on. But, you know, one of the things that I kind of got from him was not so much like bad crowd, but like, it's one of those things where, you know how people, like, you have folks who are more about pursuing their dreams. Like, they have dreams of, you know, I don't know, maybe you want to be a, you know, a famous sculptor or a painter or, you know, a singer or something like that. And it's not really panning out for you. Like, right away. And everybody around those people, first thing, like, the people who don't really believe in your dream, mm-hmm. will tell you, like, yo, you need to go get a job or something.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Mean, and I got a lot of that from him. Like, you know, maybe his family, or, well, his mom so much was on he's not a religious man. He wasn't godly in, mm-hmm. in the ways in which she thought he should be godly. But, like, you get a lot of that, like, they didn't understand him in the sense of, he had not only just his love for Tish, but he did have a love for his ability to create, his ability to work with his hands, his ability to kind of make things that, you know, make something out of things that folks wouldn't necessarily deem redeemable, mm-hmm. so to speak. And I got that more so than, you know, Bad Crowd or whatever. I got, like, he was an artist, and he was a starving artist in the sense that most, you know, we think about starving artists, but I just felt like it was the fact that a lot of folks outside of Tish and her family, most folks just didn't necessarily understand that.
Mm-hmm. And he was also the kind of person that, like, he could acknowledge the fact that he ain't have any money, mm-hmm. but he also was fine, kind of fine with it. It was like he was the kind of person that valued being able to wake up every day and do what he loved mm-hmm. more than having, like, fancy things and this, that, and the other and having a lot of money.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, you know, he's a dreamer. Like a...
Well, I also think that, like, being with a woman like Tish kind of helped him with that. You know what I'm saying? Like, where, if the person that you love is okay with you pursuing your dream, and is 100% behind you pursuing that dream, they're with you 100% of the way, I think that kind of lends to him feeling comfortable to be able to kind of live that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he had been with anybody else other than Tish, I don't know if he'd have been like as, you know, we don't, you know, just I feel like there would, I mean, shit, it just wouldn't be a story.
Well, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he would be that way regardless because it seemed they weren't, okay. Before the movie starts, mm-hmm. we are to pretty much understand that they weren't really together. It was like we kind of witnessed the first moment that she knew that he was in love with her
mm-hmm.
when they kind of look at each other. So it's like, yes, they've known each other all of their lives and they have loved each other all their lives. Mm-hmm. But this is the beginning of their relationship, really. Right. What we're getting into when they're like looking for a place and like doing, you know, doing all that. Like this is kind of the beginning of their relationship. So I think regardless of whether he would have been with her, I think he still would have been the same kind of person. But that's something we'll never know.
Well, yeah, I just got, like I said, I just got the impression that because of the way that his family reacted to it and the way that her family reacted to it, and not only that, like she said, he used to make a lot of the things, and like he would spend more time at their house than he would with his own family. Mm-hmm. So it'll just get the impression that, like, not only has he been in love with her for all his life, but that, you know, this is something like... Her family was a lot more accepting of him being who he was than his own family was outside of his father.
Yeah.
And his own father, I think that was another interesting thing too, was the conversation between the dads and Mr. Hunt, Frank Hunt, which was played by Michael Beach, and Joseph Rivers, who was played by Coleman Domingo. There was a conversation about, you know, them being grandparents. Yo, your son is about to be the father to my daughter's, you know, baby and everything, and you know, they're trying to figure out how to get, you know, monies to get Sharon Rivers down to Puerto Rico to talk to this woman who's accused Fonny of rape, and you know, they're trying to, you know, get the funds to get him, you know, his lawyer, you know, paid and things like that, and they're trying to figure out ways to do all of these things, and you know, it was an interesting thing. It was an interesting concept or a conversation about, you know, like money and raising children and being ready. You know what I'm saying? Like we talk, you know, talking about, you know, being ready for children and, you know, that whole conversation, like you're never really ready.
I mean, no, that's not true.
No. In the ways in which they were talking about it, it was like, yo, you know, he said, do you have money now? He said, no. He like, you didn't have money when you had them, but you had them and you made a way to make it happen. And you didn't have money then. So why worry about it now? It was just an interesting conversation about just being prepared or being willing to do pretty much whatever it took to take care of the people that you love. And I think that was a conversation around, you know, that conversation was was kind of profound because Michael Beach's character, which I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank of what his name was again, Frank Hunt, was worried about his relationship with his son, his respect for his son, or how much respect his son had for him because of the fact that he was still locked up in prison and he couldn't get him out. And he felt like he was inadequate as a father. I sometimes wonder if like my father felt that way about me.
What?
I do. Like, I sometimes wonder if my father felt that way about his kids. Like, he was inadequate. I sometimes wonder about that. Like, whether or not there was... Why are you shaking your head?
Why do you wonder that? If he didn't want... He didn't want to have anything to do with you. Why?
Okay. So...
Why?
It wasn't he didn't want anything to do with me. That wasn't how that played out. Maybe I shouldn't have even said that shit. Because that's not what that was. But okay. I'm talking about the relationship between a father and a son. Mm-hmm. And whether or not a father feels inadequate. And because he feels inadequate, doesn't necessarily do the things that a father should. Because he doesn't feel like he has the ability to. I'm not talking about whether or not a father wants anything to do with a son. I'm talking about the inability to do what you feel as a man you should be able to do and whether or not your son respects you for it.
Well, that's why I was saying, like, to have that feeling, you have to want to be that for your child. You have to have that kind of relationship with your son to be concerned about what they think of you and to be concerned about like what you can do for them or how they may feel. Like, don't you kind of have to have a kind of a relationship with your child? Like, you have to want to be there. You have to want to do things for them. You have to want to be a big part of their life, right?
Indeed. I guess where I may not necessarily be articulating this correctly is that
I think, just to put it simply, he was sad that he was failing his son. He had sad that his son was left in jail and that he felt helpless.
He felt helpless.
He couldn't fix it. He couldn't just save him or rescue him.
And that brings about
feelings of like, am I enough? Do I have enough? You know, am I a good enough person? Am I a good provider? Like, those kind of feelings. I don't know necessarily if I got from it that he felt that his son was,
from that scene, that's kind of what I was getting though. Like, that he felt like maybe his son didn't think that he was adequate as a father. Like, mm-hmm. he was second guessing his abilities. Excuse me. That he was second guessing his abilities as a father because his son was still sitting there. And even despite up to that point, all of his efforts, he wasn't able to get his son out of prison, and maybe his son would feel a certain type of way about him. And that's what I was getting from that scene. And then Coleman Domingo's character, Joseph Rivers, was kind of telling him, like, yo, like, even with all that, like, I know some hustles. You know some hustles. We could kind of, like, there's still more that you can do. You know what I'm saying? Like, there was that. Like, he was trying to talk him up. Like, there's still more that you can do to try to help your son. And beyond that, to kind of move this process forward to where we can get these kids back together. Because I felt like that was the ultimate goal of everybody around them, was to get these kids back together to ultimately raise this child that was coming.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You got this confused look on.
I'm not confused at all.
Oh, okay. All right, then. So, yeah. Overall, baby, what did you think about this film? Like five on a 5-star scale, what would you give it?
Oh, definitely 5. I mean, I loved it. I thought I thought it was one of those movies that, like, probably, I mean, sad to say, I would have rather go see it, like, on my own, or, like, in a theater, in an empty theater, because it's one of those movies where I would want to let myself be emotional and let myself really feel it. And I think when, you know, there's, like, other people around or whatever, you don't want to, like, sit there and be, like, weeping and be, like, emotional. But there's so many things that, like, I think this movie brought a lot of feelings and stuff that are hard to express, and a lot of, like, emotions, and just, it made you really think about things, not necessarily things that you want to, like, share and talk about. But it's, like, one of those movies where if you have not seen the movie, well, sorry, we spoiled it for you, but if you still want to go see it, I would say, like, let yourself go, like, let yourself cry, let yourself really, like, feel it. So I think you'll get a lot more out of it. But I mean, definitely I would give it 5 stars.
Yeah, I give it 5 stars also. I thought the cinematography was beautiful. This is actually, like, not one of the, you know, the kinds of movies that I normally just, like, want to go see. Mm-hmm. But I did want to go see this. It's a black love story. There's also some tragedy involved in it, but I don't think the tragedy overwhelms the overall theme of the film, which was the fact that, you know, these people would do practically whatever it took to be together. And it was a beautiful story. And I'm glad I went to go see it. I'm glad I went to go see it. So I'll give it 5 stars as well. But yeah, that has been our review of If Beale Street Could Talk. So we'll talk to you guys again soon. But until next time, fam, peace.
Bye.